From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, new federal guidance threatens incoming international student status for fall.
Our international students, they come here after years and years of preparation. They're often the best and brightest in their family.
Also, the coronavirus crashes the 2020 wedding circuit.
You know, we thought about it for a day or two, and then that Sunday we made the choice to officially call it off. We were hoping to figure out a way to still get married.
One bride and groom tell us the story of their big day deferred, and one Michigan researcher's project on the intense social lives of wasps, checking each other out like it's a night at the Roxbury.
They just put their little antenna out straight and they turn their head to watch. I mean, their eyes don't move, right? So they have to move their whole head when they're watching something. So that makes it a lot easier to see what they're watching.
Those stories and more coming up this hour. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, one Michigan town makes a play to become part of aerospace future.
We have hundreds of defense contractors that are either in the city of Sterling Heights or Macomb County, and thousands of jobs that are defense related here already.
But first, Michigan's colleges, universities, and students are scrambling to adjust their plans for fall after some new guidance came from the federal government yesterday about people who are here in the country on student visas. The Department of Homeland Security has made modifications to the Student and Exchange Visitor Program. Most universities and colleges have not been holding in-person classes or operations since spring because of COVID. We now know that the State Department does not intend to issue visas to students enrolled in schools or programs that aren't doing instruction in person for fall semester. Krista McCallum-Beatty is director of the Office for International Students and Scholars at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Krista, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
When news of this guidance came down, what was the immediate reaction from the students you know?
Our international students at Michigan State were very concerned about this. We have been waiting for the government to issue guidance on fall semester, and so students have been watching media sources for this information, and they reacted with a lot of questions and, frankly, a lot of confusion.
Can you give us a sense of the range of places that your students hail from?
Sure. The international student body at Michigan State is over 6,000 students and represents over 140 countries. Our top sending countries are China and India, South Korea, Taiwan, Canada, Iran, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, Turkey. But really, we have a very global, diverse international student community at State.
Yeah. Do you have a gut reaction at this point on whether this guidance that's been issued will mean that some will have to leave the country?
I think when looking at this guidance, I think it's important to pay attention to the first section that divides institutions into three different categories depending on their plan for fall semester. At Michigan State, we fall into what they're calling the hybrid model because we will be offering in-person classes as well as online classes. And so this guidance affects students differently depending on their school. For schools unlike Michigan State that are fully online, the way it's looking now, their international students are going to have to depart the U.S. However, at Michigan State, our international students will be able to stay here and enroll in classes. They will have to take at least some in-person courses, but it looks like they will have more flexibility than usual in terms of the number of online courses they can count towards maintaining their immigration status.
One question I had on reading what DHS issued is whether or not intention is going to matter very much. Right now, schools like MSU have intention of going forward on a hybrid model. But let's say Michigan experiences another surge in August. If the governor brings the state back into a form of lockdown, is that going to make any difference in how DHS is calculating who's in compliance and who's not?
That's one of the big questions about this guidance. One of the challenges is when the government issues something like this, it raises a lot of questions, and then we wait for further clarification from the government, and that's one of the areas we need further clarification.
Do you have many students waiting to get into the country right now?
That's a good question. We've been trying to contact as many students as possible to find out where they are this summer and what their plans are for fall. We were able to reach out to students before the end of spring semester and estimate that between 60 and 70% of our current students actually remained either in East Lansing, the greater Michigan area, or some of them went to stay with friends or family members in other states, but they remained in the U.S. What students are doing over the summer is a little harder to wrap our hands around. And then, of course, we have a great class of incoming international students hoping to start at Michigan State or planning to start at Michigan State this fall. Those students face several obstacles to getting here. First of all, the U.S. embassies and consulates abroad remain closed to student visa applications, so students are unable to apply for a visa to enter the U.S. And then, as you know, many countries face restrictions on entering the U.S. because of the pandemic. So there are lots of challenges for our international students right now.
What might the options be for anyone who was enrolled and had intended to come, but can't get the visa issues worked out?
Well, students are still going to be able to continue to pursue their degree at Michigan State through online courses. I've been just so impressed by our faculty and our academic programs that are reaching out to us asking, as we make these decisions about our classes for fall semester, what do we need to keep in mind so that we can continue to support our international students and help them achieve their dreams of graduating from Michigan State? So I think there are going to be options for students who cannot get here in terms of completing their degree. Some of the immigration options may go away because if they're not in the U.S., it may be harder for them to maintain their immigration status. Mm-hmm. But they certainly will be able to complete their degree in most cases that I'm aware of.
I mean, is that going to be satisfactory for all of them?
I think it depends on the student. I mean, I can't speak for 6,000 plus students. I know many of them have their hearts set on graduating from Michigan State and then staying and getting some practical education by completing internships or volunteering or working in this country for a while. And depending on their unique situation, that may be a little harder to do now.
I know that the federal government is going to publish this guidance as part of a temporary final rule, to use the bureaucratic term of art. Do you think that that's going to give the clarity that the university needs?
We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Krista, I know that as we're having this conversation, you've just come from a meeting with some of the students who are enrolled. What kinds of things were they saying about where they are in this moment?
They're looking for clarity and guidance. Our international students really, they come here after years and years of preparation. They're often the best and brightest in their family, and their extended family is pooling their resources to get their student here. So they really want to be successful. They really want to follow the immigration laws. And they're just looking for answers about, okay, what do I need to do to maintain my immigration status and continue to progress towards completing my degree here at MSU? And they're also looking for support from the university. And again, I think our faculty are very willing to support our students and work with them. President Stanley certainly is very supportive of our international student population as well. So that's what the students are looking for. It's how can I continue to pursue my dream of graduating from Michigan State?
I can only imagine what it's like trying to maintain the program that you run right now, not just with all the policy questions facing us, but with the coronavirus still very much in play. Do you have concerns about long-term effects on enrollment from places overseas?
I think the pandemic is going to change international education in ways yet to be seen. But the U.S. will continue to be a destination of choice for students from around the world. We've been a leader in global education for decades and will continue to be so. Schools like Michigan State have a great reputation globally. We provide a solid education, and that's not going to change. How we deliver that education may change post-pandemic, but that's yet to be seen.
I think it's not always obvious to those who don't run in academic circles how global the entire academic community is, too. I mean, people go to conferences, they do research projects with people in other parts of the world, and I imagine that the entire system is going through some pretty serious disruptions.
I think so. I think in my office, certainly for me personally, I'm learning a ton from my students on how to operate in a virtual world. You mentioned the meeting I just came with from, it was with a whole bunch of our outstanding student leaders. I think we had people calling in from 5 different countries and 7 and 6 different time zones. And they're very comfortable in that environment. And I'm learning so much from the students right now. So it's reinforcing what you're just saying. Higher education has been a global endeavor for years, and I think we're learning that more and more every day.
Krista McCallum-Beatty directs the Office for International Students and Scholars at Michigan State. Krista, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We need to take a moment today in a year of so many losses to mark the passing of one man much loved in Detroit. The Detroit News reports DeAndre Watson, age 30, has died, the apparent victim of a murder-suicide. The case is still under investigation. Watson worked in the office of City District 1 under James Tate. He was young, but had already made a name for himself in neighborhood outreach, planning and economic development. His boss described him as both dynamic and dogged with details. Watson was scheduled to start law school at the University of Michigan this fall. You can find the full article link in our Twitter feed. Coming up, weddings are plenty stressful enough without a global pandemic. We'll be speaking with a manager from a wedding venue and with one couple about how the big day is changing.
You know, I think as much as it is impacting us as a business, we are feeling for our couples during this difficult time and are happy to work with them to figure out a way to accommodate, you know, even though it is going to impact our business.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There is a lot of depressing deferred stuff right now. We'd like to take a moment to salute the families who had big celebrations planned for the summer, like weddings. Big splashy weddings aren't a recipe for a happy marriage, nor are they a thing for everybody. But for some, a wedding is an event that people dream about and plan for years. As couples navigate their tough decisions, venues are also feeling pinched and juggling a lot of rebookings. Rebecca Moser is general manager at Castle Farms. If you don't know, it is a gorgeous venue for weddings and other events in Charlevoix. Rebecca Moser, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. I'm happy to be here.
So wedding venues were among those closed under the emergency order and have remained closed for several months. How did that impact Castle Farms' bottom line?
Yeah, you know, we're still actually calculating what exactly this is going to impact us. You know, understandably, we had income that we were expecting from weddings this year, and now we're actually seeing that this is going to be affecting us a little bit longer term as we have postponements into next year. Of course, preventing us from potentially reserving a new reservation on those dates. You know, I think as much as it is impacting us as a business, we are feeling for our couples during this difficult time and are happy to work with them to figure out a way to accommodate, you know, even though it is going to impact our business. So as far as, you know, actual numbers, I think it's going to be a bit before we can see the full impact for sure.
So how do you even do the logistics of this when you have people who couldn't hold weddings in April and May and a calendar that may just have a lot of uncertainty for the rest of the year and going into next?
Absolutely. It's been a learning experience as we go and definitely some trial and error and finding the best way to accommodate our couples. thankfully for us, and I know this isn't the case for many venues or many couples during this hard time, we actually do offer a postponement option for our couples. So in our original contract, thankfully for those couples going through this difficult transition, they knew going in that they had an opportunity to be able to postpone actually up to a year from their original date. So we did see early on in March when we first were shut down and we didn't know how long this was going to affect us, some of those couples chose to push their wedding date later to this year. And actually, unfortunately, some of those couples are rescheduling for a second time into next year because of all of these changes. So navigating it has been just a case-by-case basis, connecting with our couples individually to find out what's going to work best for them, what we are able to do within our contract terms, and making some slight altercations to our contract to make sure that we can accommodate our couples the best we are able to.
I have to ask, having been a rather amped up bride myself, have any brides cried as you've been talking to them?
Absolutely. And that's understandable. You know, this is such a high emotion event. You're emotionally invested in your wedding. You've been planning for a year, sometimes 2 years, and to see all of those things that you were looking forward to changing, it's going to be emotional. And I think we've tried really hard to find that empathy, and we feel it ourselves. We understand this is our heart and soul. We absolutely love what we do as coordinators at the castle. And so I think being a sounding board for our couples to be able to let it out and cry a little bit that they're disappointed is okay. It has changed our communication with our couples actually pretty dramatically. We've always been a very personal experience for couples. We want them to get to know us and to feel comfortable with us, but I think we're now getting to know our couples on a much deeper level. I think we're being very open and very honest and having just different types of conversations than we would have necessarily had, you know, 6 months ago. That professional boundary of friend and professional is a little bit more blurred when you have to be so open and raw when it comes to dealing with COVID. And I think that our coordinators have found that perfect balance of keeping it a professional boundary, but also feeling with our couples and crying with our couples and letting them know that we understand that it's difficult and we're feeling it also.
When you were deciding how to reopen, what were your biggest concerns?
Safety of our staff and actually of our guests and our couples was probably among the number one concern. You know, we actually are in a region where we are able to be open at this point for a larger capacity than most of the state. We are considered to be in a region where we can actually have a capacity inside of 25% of our current fire code capacity. So that gives us a range of up to about 100, 150 people in some of our locations. So when we're looking at our reopening plan, following the executive orders to the absolute best of our ability was number one, because those orders are put in place for a reason. You know, we want to keep our staff safe when we're having people attend a large event, and we want to keep those guests that are attending feeling comfortable and feeling safe that they're going to be able to attend an event and not have a huge risk put on them as far as potentially contracting COVID.
Rebecca, as we've seen over the past couple of weeks, there are some businesses that reopened with some strict rules and cleaning policies and plans for social distancing and masks for staff. And they found that some individuals were not okay following those rules. How, as a venue, how can you handle that? Are you telling couples things about what's expected of them and their guests?
So we actually have not had our first event post-COVID yet. It'll actually be this upcoming weekend will be our first wedding of the season. And we are being very open and very clear with our couples about what's expected and how giving them suggestions of how to communicate those to their guests ahead of time. And, you know, making sure guests plan to bring a mask, making sure guests know that they're going to be expected certain things throughout the, you know, wedding event. So weddings are definitely looking very different. I see some long-term potential changes for how people plan weddings, how people, you know, plan their decor or plan their food and dessert stations. But we are doing our absolute best to make sure that we have very clear guidelines set out to our couples and letting them make the decision whether or not that they're okay having a wedding under those guidelines or if they're choosing to postpone because there are some that may not want to wear a mask during moving up and about in the room. Or there might be some that choose, you know, we don't want to have to cut our guest count. And that's okay. And we're working with them to accommodate a different date if that's the case.
I noticed the Castle Farms website says there's always a silver lining. I think you get the Optimus Prize for the year.
Well, thank you. We've been definitely trying to encourage our couples that we're still excited to have their event, even though this is an absolute unprecedented time of uncertainty for ourselves and for our couples. If they still want to have their event, we still want to make sure that they know we're excited. It might be different. It might look different. It might feel a little bit different. But we are going to make the best of what we're able to do and what we're able to accommodate while still being safe and still following those executive orders.
Rebecca Moser, General Manager at Castle Farms in Charlevoix. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much for the time, and I appreciate the talk today.
The honeymoon is already over for the Michigan brides and grooms who have a lot more time on their hands than they may have expected this summer. Shelley and Corey Von Aachen were set to tie the knot on April 4th in Detroit. And a mere 2 weeks before everything was finalized, COVID struck. They join us now. Shelley, Corey, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Hi.
You two had such great plans. You were set to get married at the Guardian Building, right?
Yeah, we were. We were going to have about 170-ish people at the Guardian Building in downtown Detroit to celebrate our wedding in the beginning of April.
For those who don't know, the Guardian is this just breathtaking Art Deco structure. How far in advance did you have to reserve that?
I think we reserved in early October is when we decided on the Guardian Building.
Oh my gosh! So there's one bit of money that is probably not coming back anytime soon. Was the venue very very helpful in trying to get some alternative arrangements planned?
Yeah, everyone was pretty great. Although we weren't able to get any money back, we were able to secure another date for next April. So we're hoping that things improve and we can have a celebration next April at the Guardian Building using some of the vendors that we had already given deposits to.
But the space that we were going to have the reception, actually, they're not going to have available for receptions anymore. So we're going to use a different space in the Guardian Building. So plans have changed a little bit, but I guess a year later, I guess that's to be expected.
No kidding. Corey, did you guys have your marriage license all set to go?
No, we did not, because I had been traveling for work. And so that was one of the things that once I got back, we were hoping to do. And we didn't get that done before everything shut down.
So, I mean, when we say there was no wedding, there's also kind of no marriage license, which means no documentation of you two as a couple, even if you did try to scale back the plans.
Yeah, we were hoping to do that. We were saying, man, well, if we could just get a marriage license. And actually, Shelley's mom had told us it was the week after the 13th. So it would have been, you know, the week of March 16th. And Shelley's mom said, you guys should go get your marriage license now. But we had already come out to the west side of Michigan.
Do you remember the day when you realized everything was going sideways?
Yeah, I'm pretty much, it was, I think, March 13th. I'm a teacher. So on like the evening of March 12th, schools were canceled in Michigan till April 6th. And it just seemed like this isn't going to happen. And so we didn't, you know, we thought about it for a day or two. And then that Sunday, we made the choice to like officially call it off. And that was sad. But we were hoping to figure out a way to still get married.
You guys had a pretty sizable guest list, 170-ish people. Were many of those folks coming in from out of town?
A lot were. Yeah, Corey's actually originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm originally from Charlottesville, Virginia. So we had a lot of family traveling from lots of different places. And then Corey also worked in Brazil and lived there for 3 years, so we had some people coming internationally too.
Oh, man. That is just tough. I'm just rolling through in my mind everything that one has to rearrange in this situation. You have to figure out what to tell your celebrant, the caterer, the floral company, the issue of the reception hall that you already mentioned. I mean, putting a wedding in motion is a lot of work. I can only imagine how much work it is to sort of undo everything that you'd planned.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure it's tough too for all the different vendors and businesses, because they're trying to figure out what to do. And, you know, even a week before everything really shut down, we sent a message to everybody saying, hey, are we still good for this? And everyone said, well, we're going to be as safe as we can, but, you know, we'll try and have the show go on. But then, you know, after everything really shut down, there was nothing we could do. But I think some businesses we had a little bit of a tougher time getting a hold of, because they were probably, you know, in first place trying to figure out what they were going to do with their businesses during this whole situation. So, you know, we tried to be respectful of that too, to say, hey, you know, we understand our wedding is not necessarily the number one priority, but it was nice. Everyone was really gracious and helpful. So it's, although not ideal, it's worked out okay.
Did you decide to do anything special on April 4th, the day that you'd planned to get married?
We didn't decide to do anything special, but our family decided to do something special for us. So Corey's sister actually had sent out an email to gather videos from all different people in our family and in our wedding party. And then the night of April 4th, they sent us that video. And then we were supposed to have like a family Zoom call, like a game night or something. And they surprised us because it was like a ton of people too. So that was fun. You know, we did a little first dance for people on Zoom, even though we weren't really married.
Oh, that is so cute.
To cheer us up a little.
Yeah, we had a little Zoom dance party with all, I don't know, at least 50 people on the call. So it was kind of funny.
Do you guys mind telling us your meet cute story, the story of how you became a couple?
Yeah. So we both lived in Detroit in the New Center neighborhood. And Corey lived in a house down the street from me. And there's some really big houses in that neighborhood. And we both lived in big houses with lots of housemates, and I was babysitting at the house that Corey was living in, and so I met him there. And then, you know, he lived on the street, and I would see him then sometimes at our gym. We went to the same gym. And then I, like I said, I'm a teacher, and I got kind of roped into coaching soccer at the school I'm working at. They were like, no one can play soccer if someone doesn't volunteer. So I did it, but I knew nothing about soccer. But then I would notice that Corey wore all these soccer shirts to the gym. So I was like, I'm going to get this guy to help me coach soccer. And then the rest is history. So we became closer friends. And yeah, we've been together for 4 years.
That's a good strategy. And it sounds like you were able to have something of a celebration with people you're close to on the lake in June, right?
In May, actually. So in early May, we finally got through to the Wayne County clerk. It was pretty funny, actually. We were on a walk, and Corey was like, maybe it's not meant for us to get married right now. And then it was like divine intervention. He got a call from the Wayne County clerk, and they were like, you can come get a marriage license. Like, here's this crazy process to, you know, get an appointment and contactless and all that sort of stuff. And then we got a marriage license in, I don't know, the first or second week of May. And then we were able to kind of coordinate with our closest family for them to come up. And on May 23rd, we had a wedding of about 12 people total. Right at our little lake cottage. So it was really nice.
I like it. Very old school. Would you say the delay in your formal plans, do you think it means anything in how you guys feel about being together right now?
Not for me. You know, we had been discussing and contemplating getting married for a while now. And so we were just kind of waiting for the right time with our siblings getting married and things like that. So we were ready for this move and all of that. So it was somewhat of a formality, especially since we've been living together for a couple years by the time we decided to make it official to get married. So not a ton has changed.
No, nothing's really changed. And I you know, my mom, she likes to joke sometimes. And she was like, in the beginning of all this, when everyone was quarantining at home, she was like, you know, if you can be like the only people you see each day, every day, all day, you guys are definitely going to make it. I mean, I agree. You know, we get to spend a lot of time together and we love each other a lot. And we're happy. We're happy that we're together and grateful for that.
So how is quarantine working out, newlyweds?
It's great, you know. I think I could probably do Corey's job because I listen to it work. And
I think I could not do Shelly's job because teaching
virtually is a challenge.
Oh. Well, listen, you two, we really appreciate your being willing to tell us about this, and we're sorry about your plans, but it sounds like you've been able to make the best of a bad situation.
Yeah, it's not been so bad. Like Shelly said, it's just nice that we can be together and be here. And it did work out, you know, eventually. It wasn't quite the way we planned it, but we pulled it off, and it's kind of a funny story to tell down the road.
Corey and Shelly Van Aken of Detroit. Guys, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, April. Thanks, everybody.
Next up, the insect equivalent of Facebook, where wasps size each other up and attack accordingly.
Being socially smart is thought to be one of the most complicated things and one of the main reasons things like primates or dolphins or humans have these giant brains. So I'm really interested in learning more about how much a tiny-brained little wasp can do.
One Michigan scientist fills us in on her research after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There's plenty to adore about Michigan summers, but I'm betting that wasps are not at the top of many people's lists. And yet here they are every year, nesting in your eaves, hovering over your garden, dashing about in an erratic flight pattern that can intimidate the biggest bug lovers among us when we're having dinner outdoors. New research from our next guest might bolster your fear of the nefarious intentions of wasps, or they could just give you a lot more respect for a way these amazing creatures socialize. You know that thing you do when you find out that you and a coworker are in line for the same promotion? Turns out that's a thing with wasps, too. Elizabeth Tibbetts is a professor in the University of Michigan's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and she joins us now. Liz, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
What did you notice about the behavior of wasps that led you to this research?
Well, the first thing I noticed is that they all have really different faces. So, you know, you look at a couple squirrels, they look pretty much identical. But if you look at a bunch of wasps of the same species, they all look unique.
You're kidding.
Yeah, I wondered why. Why do they all have different faces? So I did some experiments and showed that they have individual face recognition.
What kinds of features tend to vary on a wasp's head?
Yeah, so they have different brown, black, and yellow marks. They've got little eyebrow stripes. They have different patterns around their mouth. You have to get pretty close to see them. So I understand most people probably have not seen them, but they do look really different when you get a good look.
For this research that you published recently, you collected female paper wasps from sites around Ann Arbor in early spring. Could you tell us, first off, how paper wasp colonies are structured?
Yeah, so I'm sure everyone has seen them. They like nesting on the eaves of houses or in your barbecue grill, underneath your porch railing. And it starts out with one queen who's overwintered. She comes out in the spring, flies around, finds a good place to nest. And then she starts building. It looks kind of like an open honeycomb made out of paper.
And I know that you said that there's a queen. Are they structured in the same way that honeybee colonies are structured, where the queen basically directs everything that's going on with the other members of the colony?
Yeah, so the paper wasp world is very different from the honeybee world. So with the honeybee, you've got one queen, you got a bunch of workers, and all the workers are like cells kind of working for the colony. They don't care about their own life. They're just there for the good of the group. But in paper wasps, everyone is very selfish. So you often have a bunch of queens cooperating with each other. And they are cooperative, but they're also looking out for themselves. They try to get as much as they can. They compete with each other over how much they get. And then if they don't get a good enough deal, they leave and try to find a better deal somewhere else. So that makes them exciting to study because they have so many different interactions going on.
The wasps that you collected were marked. The people on your team used enamel to mark their thoraxes so that you could tell them apart with different color patterns. I was wondering who the lucky devil was who got that job.
So actually, I think for this project, it was a bunch of undergraduates at U of M.
Of course it was.
Yeah. It sounds hard, but it's actually not. You know, you just wear these gloves they can't sting through. And paper wasps are not as aggressive as you would think. I studied them for about 10 years before I got my first sting.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So you took the wasps. There were pairs of fighter wasps that were placed two at a time in little containers, a sort of a Thunderdome fighting arena for wasps. And then there were bystander wasps that were able to observe through clear plastic partitions. And I understand that you could tell they were indeed watching. How could you tell that?
Well, we just watched, you know, what they were doing, and sometimes they ignored the fighters, but often they would, you know, turn and follow the fighters and watch what the fighters were doing. And you can tell when animals are watching each other.
What behaviors, like, how can you tell?
Yeah, how can you tell? That's a good question, because it seems obvious when you're looking at it. I guess
it's not like a dog watching a squirrel.
Yeah, it's just like a dog watching a squirrel.
Oh, it is. Okay.
That's a great way to describe it.
Okay.
They just like put their little antenna out straight and they turn their head to watch. I mean, their eyes don't move, right? So they have to move their whole head when they're watching something. So that makes it a lot easier to see what they're watching.
Could you explain the next stage of the experiment and then what you did with the bystanders?
Yeah, so it's a little complicated, maybe not. So we had some fighters and then we had some watchers. And so what we did after those trials were done is we took some watchers and we paired them up with fighters. And we did two different kinds of trials. So sometimes we had an observer interact with a fighter who she'd seen fight. So like, let's say she saw Susie fight. We'd pair her up with Susie and then see how she treated Susie. Other wasps, we took them and we paired them up with a wasp they'd never seen before. And then we wanted to know, did they behave differently with Susie, who they'd seen, versus like Jolene, who they'd never seen before?
Well, what kind of decisions did you see the bystanders making?
Yeah, so it looked like the bystanders were really paying close attention, and they were making decisions about how to interact based on what they'd seen before. So if they saw Susie being a super badass, beating up the other wasp, when they actually got to interact with Susie, they basically instantly gave up and they said, okay, you're too tough. I'm not even going to try to fight with you.
Wow.
Yeah. So they really were paying attention. On the other hand, you know, you had controls where you had them interact with a fighter they'd never seen before. And of course, they didn't know anything about the fighter. So they just behaved like they didn't know anything.
Is this surprising in the world of invertebrates?
So it's not surprising to us as humans, maybe, because our entire social lives are built around watching each other interact. If you think about your life, you spend a lot of time paying attention to other people, figuring out who's strong, who's pretty, who's rich, and who's not.
Uh-huh.
But most animals don't do that. They just pay attention to who they interact with directly. If they fight with someone, they remember whether they won or they lost, but they don't spend time paying attention to all the other interactions around them, because it's thought to be pretty complicated. It makes your social life much more difficult if you're paying attention to the whole world, not just interactions that directly involve you.
So what was your takeaway about, I guess, wasp society out of all this that you didn't have before?
Well, I've been studying wasps for 20 years, which is a pretty long time. And usually I keep finding they can do these incredibly complicated things. And this is the one study I really did not expect to work. I really did not think that they were paying attention to these social interactions they weren't involved in directly. So I was thrilled. And it was a really exciting result for me to find that they do have these kind of complex social networks. So not only are they remembering individuals that they interact with directly, they're paying attention to this whole network of other interactions. And that's thought to be pretty complex. And in fact, in humans, people think that one of the reasons we have really big brains is so we can keep track of all those social interactions.
Turns out you can have a tiny brain like a wasp and do the same thing.
Exactly. Their brain is like the size of a grain of rice. How can they keep track? That's amazing.
Liz, do you think they watch other kinds of creatures, like maybe us humans?
So there is actually a study showing that bees can learn human faces if you train them. So I think it's theoretically possible, but I think they have enough going on in their little wasp world that they're not going to waste too much time worrying about you.
That is so amazing and at the same time, totally creepy to me. the thought that they might be watching us.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that I haven't gotten stung. If you watch them watching you, you get a lot of information.
So what further questions did these results open up for you?
Well, I guess I'm really interested in how smart wasps actually are and how much information they can learn and remember. Because being socially smart is thought to be one of the most complicated things and one of the main reasons things like primates or dolphins or humans have these giant brains. So I'm really interested in learning more about how much a tiny-brained little wasp can do.
Do you think they might be capable of a different level of problem solving than we gave them credit for?
Definitely. They could be capable of more complicated problem solving, doing things like transitive inference, which is like kind of making guesses about each other based on what they already know. I think what they could be capable of is living in these really complicated social networks where they know lots of individuals and they remember them for a long time and they know how everyone is placed, which doesn't actually sound that complicated when you say it, but for a tiny little wasp brain, it is.
Like the equivalent of a wasp Facebook in their understanding of their social circles.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way of thinking about it. Most animals don't have that, believe it or not. They live in a really simple social world.
Well, Elizabeth Tibbetts, this is such interesting research. Thank you so much for sharing some of it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Elizabeth Tibbetts is a professor in U of M's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. It may seem difficult to think about long-term economic priorities in this moment, but that's just what long-term thinking is all about. One Michigan city is trying to lay plans right now to position itself as the new home of the United States Space Command. Next January, the Air Force is scheduled to make a decision on where this new headquarters will be located. And among the cities in the running is Michigan's own Sterling Heights. Sterling Heights Mayor Michael Taylor joins us now. Michael, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April.
Tell us a little about Sterling Heights' history with defense contracting.
Well, this would be a new thing for us, but not new in terms of our experience with defense contracting. We have a number of defense contractors located in Sterling Heights, including General Dynamics Land Systems headquarters and a large BAE presence. We have hundreds of defense contractors that are either in the city of Sterling Heights or Macomb County, and thousands of jobs that are defense related here already. Our County Executive Mark Hackle refers to this area as the arsenal of democracy and proudly declares that Macomb County is already the defense capital of the Midwest and possibly the United States. So while people might not think of Sterling Heights as a hub for military bases, we already have that experience and that talent here.
When you think of the whole picture, of course, having industries that have experience in this, I'm sure is probably one piece of it. But are there other things that you had to express in your pitch to the Air Force, like I guess the educational assets and things that they might be looking for as well?
Well, as of right now, the Air Force has a pretty regimented way of applying and nominating. The Air Force actually provided the nomination template, and you just had to meet certain criteria in order to even apply. So right now, we're within 25 miles of a military base, and that would be Selfridge Air National Guard Base. We have a livability index in Sterling Heights that's high enough to meet their criteria, and we're in one of the metropolitan areas that they identified that would qualify us. And then my understanding is that they're going to reach out to us once they receive the application, which they already have, and follow up. And we're meeting with the county, city, and Selfridge are meeting and putting together that proposal that we're going to be providing. And we anticipate in the coming weeks that we're going to be providing a very, very strong proposal to show why Sterling Heights, Macomb County, and Selfridge is not only qualified, but the highest qualified area in the entire country.
I mean, this is a pretty big project. What would 1,400 new jobs mean for Sterling Heights?
Well, it would be incredible. I mean, we're no stranger to having large manufacturing companies and big projects that involve a lot of new jobs. What this would do is really bring us into a totally different industry, a new industry with Space Command. And I think that's one of the highest profile things out there right now is defending our assets, our satellites, and defending our country from, you know, other hostile nations that are trying to, you know, do us harm. And so that's the new frontier, frankly, is outer space. And so for Sterling Heights to be the headquarters, I think it would be a very high profile project that would bring a lot of attention to the city and to the county and do great things, have a huge multiplier effect on jobs in a number of different industries.
I was looking over the list of cities that are trying to compete for the facility. I mean, you're going up against places like Dayton, the home of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and Palmdale, California, home to Edwards Air Force Base. Do you think Sterling Heights is going to be able to compete with places like that?
I wouldn't have put our name in and nominated Sterling Heights if I didn't think we had a legitimate chance. Look, I know that this is going to be a very competitive process, and we're going to get stiff competition from other areas. But we're proud to tell the story of what we have here in Macomb County in Sterling Heights. And we'll be happy to stand up and show that we can compete with any one of these locations. And even though traditionally we're not thought of as a hub for, you know, for the Air Force or for these sorts of aerospace jobs, we really are. Our proximity to the talent and infrastructure makes Michigan and Macomb County uniquely qualified, in my opinion, to compete with any city across the country and show why we belong.
This is a larger entity, the United States Space Command, than the Space Force that President Trump has outlined, but it would have dominion over the Space Force, which has a pretty explicit military mission. Is it of any concern to you, the prospect of a more militarized approach to aerospace, or maybe even just the possibility that future federal administrations might see the picture differently?
Well, you know, those sorts of discussions, I think, I'll leave for the federal politicians and for the commanders in the United States Air Force. And, you know, I'm confident that they'll be able to direct the mission to what is most appropriate for our country and for our citizens. But as I mentioned, you know, there are a number of assets that the United States relies on that are up in outer space, our satellites. And those assets need to be protected. And, you know, as we get into a changing world with our foreign relations, we have to start thinking, I think, about how do we protect those areas, those assets, and be positioned for a future that, you know, 50 to 100 years from now, space travel could become much more common.
Is it too soon to get a T-shirt that says Sterling Heights Space Command?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna start selling those, but you know, I might say coming soon to a city near you. We're very optimistic, but again, we know it's a competitive process. I think it has a pretty nice ring to it, though, don't you?
I do. I like that. I could totally see that. Especially maybe a ball cap. Actually, it'd be a little more appropriate. A little more Chuck Yeager.
Yes.
Are there any other ways in which putting together this proposal have stretched your ideas about economic development around?
Well, we have a pretty robust economic development team in Sterling Heights, and we have. And, you know, these last 3 months have taught us that we have to start thinking differently about the way space is going to be used in Sterling Heights. And I'm not talking about outer space. I'm talking about our office locations and our retail locations and our industrial locations. And so, yeah, we've been working really around the clock the last 3 months to figure out how are we going to position Sterling Heights and Macomb County going forward in a very uncertain future. We're confident that we're going to emerge from this very strongly. And we've got a great team that's working to highlight the assets that we have here, the talent that we have here, and the opportunities for businesses, whether they're in the aerospace industry, whether they're in high tech, manufacturing, whatever the case may be. This process has helped to sharpen those tools and focus us on making sure that we're ready for industries to not only reopen, but emerge even stronger.
Well, Mayor Taylor, thanks for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Michael Taylor is the mayor of Sterling Heights. We'll all be looking forward in January to seeing the Air Force make its final decision on the new home for United States Space Command. And that's Stateside for today. The show is produced by Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and the real April on this staff, April Van Buren, with help from our interns, Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovid, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow.